Flag stood at the edge of the roof sun deck that afternoon, looking east. The sun would be going down in another 4 hours, and then the retard would be on the move again. A strong and steady desert breeze lifted his dark hair back from his hot brow. The city ended so abruptly, giving up to the desert. A few billboards on the edge of nowhere, and that was it. So much desert. So many places to hide. Men had walked into that desert before and had never been seen again. "But not this time," he whispered. "I'll have him. I'll have him." He could not have explained why it was so important to him to have the retard. The rationality of the problem constantly eluded him. More and more he felt an urge to simply act, to move, to do, to destroy. When Lloyd had informed him of the helicopter explosions and the deaths of the three pilots, he had had to use every resource at his command to keep from going into an utter screaming rage. His first impulse had been to order an armored column assembled immediately. Tanks, flame tracks, armored trucks, the whole works. They could be in Boulder in 5 days. The whole stinking mess would be over in a week and a half. Sure. And if there was early snow in the mountain passes, that would be the end of the great Wehrmacht. And it was already September 14th. Good weather was no longer a sure bet. But he was the strongest man on the face of the earth, wasn't he? There might be another like him in Russia or China or Iran, but that was a problem for 10 years from now. Now all that mattered was that he was ascendant. He knew it. He felt it. He was strong. That was all the retard could tell them, if he managed to avoid getting lost in the desert or freezing to death in the mountains. He could only tell them that Flagg's people lived in fear of the Walken Dude and would obey the Walken Dude's least command. He could only tell them things that would demoralize their will further. So why did he have this steady, gnawing feeling that Cullen must be found and killed before he could leave the West? "Because it's what I want. And I'm going to have what I want, and that is reason enough." And Trashcan Man. He had thought he could dismiss trash entirely. He had thought Trashcan Man could be thrown away like a defective tool. But he had succeeded in doing what the entire free zone could not have done. He had thrown dirt into the foolproof machinery of the Dark Man's conquest. "I misjudged." It was a hateful thought, and he would not allow his mind to follow it to its conclusion. He threw his glass out over the roof's low parapet and saw it twinkling end over end, out and out, then descending. A randomly vicious thought, a petulant child's thought, streaked across his mind. Hope it hit someone in the head. They had found no more bombs at Indian Springs. The entire place had been turned upside down. Apparently Trash had booby-trapped the first things he had come to, the choppers in Hangar 9, and the trucks in the motor pool next door. Flagg had reiterated his orders that the trash can man was to be killed on sight. The thought of Trash wandering around out in all that government property, where God knew what might be stored, now made him distinctly nervous. Nervous. Yes. The beautiful surety was still evaporating. Things were getting flaky. Lloyd knew it. He could see it in the way that Lloyd looked at him. It might not be a bad idea if Lloyd had an accident before the winter was out. He was asshole buddies with too many of the people in the palace guard, people like Whitney Horgan and Ken DeMott. Even Burleson, who had spilled that business about the Red List. He had thought idly about skinning Paul Burleson alive for that. But if Lloyd had known about the Red List, none of this would have... "Shut up," he muttered. "Just shut up." But the thought wouldn't go away that easily. Why hadn't he given Lloyd the names of the top echelon free zone people? He didn't know, couldn't remember. It seemed there had been a perfectly good reason at the time, but the more he tried to grasp it, the more it slipped through his fingers. Had it only been a sly, stupid decision not to put too many of his eggs in one basket? A feeling that not too many secrets should be stored with any one person, even a person as stupid and loyal as Lloyd Henreid? An expression of bewilderment rippled across his face. Had he been making such stupid decisions all along? And just how loyal was Lloyd, anyway? that expression in his eyes. Abruptly, he decided to push it all aside and levitate. That always made him feel better. It made him feel stronger, more serene, and it cleared his head. He looked out at the desert sky. I am, I am, I am, I am. His run-down boot heels left the surface of the sun deck, hovered, rose another inch, then two. Peace came to him, and suddenly he knew he could find the answers. Everything was clearer. First he must... They're coming for you, you know. He crashed back down at the sound of that soft, uninflected voice. The jarring shock went up his legs and his spine, all the way to his jaw, which clicked. He whirled around like a cat. But his blooming grin withered when he saw Nadine. She was dressed in a white nightgown, yards of gauzy material that billowed around her body. Her hair, as white as the gown, blew about her face. She looked like some pallid, deranged sibyl, and in spite of himself, Flagg was afraid. She took a delicate step closer. Her feet were bare. They're coming. Stu Redman, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, and Larry Underwood. They're coming, and they'll kill you like a chicken-stealing weasel. They're in Boulder, he said, hiding under their beds and mourning their dead nigger woman. No, she said indifferently. They're almost in Utah now. They'll be here soon, and they'll stamp you out like a disease. Shut up. Go downstairs. I'll go down, she said, approaching him. And now it was she who smiled, a smile that filled him with dread. The furious color faded from his cheeks, and his strange hot vitality seemed to go with it. For a moment he seemed old and frail. I'll go down, and so will you. Get out. We'll go down, she sang, smiling. It was horrible. Down, down. They're in Boulder. They're almost here. Get downstairs. Everything you made here is falling apart. And why not? The effective half-life of evil is always relatively short. People are whispering about you. They're saying you let Tom Cullen get away, just a simple retarded boy, but smart enough to outwit Randall Flagg. Her words came faster and faster, now tumbling through a jeering smile. They're saying your weapons expert has gone crazy and you didn't know it was going to happen. They're afraid that what he brings back from the desert next time may be for them instead of for the people in the East. And they're leaving. Did you know that? You lie, he whispered. His face was parchment white, his eyes bulging. If they were leaving, I'd know. Her eyes gazed blankly over his shoulder to the east. They're leaving their posts in the dead of night, and your eye doesn't see them. They're leaving their posts and sneaking away. A work crew goes out with 20 people and comes back with 18. The border guards are defecting. They're afraid the balance of power is shifting on its arm. They're leaving you, and the ones that are left won't lift a finger when the men from the east come to finish you once and for all. It snapped. Whatever there was inside him, it snapped. You lie! He screamed at her. His hands slammed down on her shoulders, snapping both collarbones like pencils. He lifted her bodily high over his head into the faded blue desert sky, and as he pivoted on his heels, he threw her up and out as he had thrown the glass. He saw the great smile of relief and triumph on her face, the sudden sanity in her eyes, and understood. She had baited him into doing it, understanding somehow that only he could set her free. And she was carrying his child. He leaned over the low parapet, almost overbalancing, trying to call back the irrevocable. Her nightgown fluttered. His hand closed on the gauzy material and he felt it rip, leaving him only a scrap of cloth so diaphanous that he could see his fingers through it. The stuff of dreams on waking. Then she was gone, plummeting straight down with her toes pointed toward the earth, her gown billowing up her neck and over her face in drifts. She didn't scream. She went down as silently as a defective skyrocket. When he heard the indescribable thud of her hard landing, Flagg threw his head back to the sky and howled. It made no difference. It made no difference. was still all in the palm of his hand. He leaned over the parapet again and watched them come running, like iron filings drawn to a magnet, or maggots to a piece of offal. They looked so small, and he was so high above them. He would levitate, he decided, and regain his state of calm. But it was a long, long time before his boot heels would leave the sun deck, and when they did, they would only hover a quarter of an inch above the concrete. They would go no higher. Tom awoke that night at 8 o'clock, but there was still too much light to move. He waited. Nick had come to him again in his sleep, and they had talked. It was so good to talk to Nick. He lay in the shade of the big rock and watched the sky darken. The stars began to peep out. He thought about Pringle's newfangled potato chips and wished he had some. When he got back to the zone, if he did get back to the zone, he would have all of them he wanted. He would gorge on Pringle's chips and bask in the love of his friends. That was what was missing back there in Las Vegas, he decided. Simple love. They were nice enough people and all, but there wasn't much love in them, because they were too busy being afraid. "I love Nick and Franny and Dick Ellis and Lucy," Tom whispered. It was his prayer. "I love Larry Underwood and Glenn Bateman, too. I love Stan and Rona. I love Ralph. I love Stu. I love..." It was odd how easily their names came to him. Why, back in the zone, he was lucky if he could remember Stu's name when he came to visit. His thoughts turned to his toys, his garage, his cars, his model trains. He had played with them by the hour. But he wondered if he would want to play with them so much when he got back from this, if he got back. It wouldn't be the same. That was sad, but maybe it was also good. "The Lord is my shepherd," he recited softly. "I shall not want for nothing. He makes me lie down in the green pastures. He greases up my head with oil. He gives me kung fu in the face of my enemies. Amen." It was dark enough now, and he pushed on. By 11:30 that night he had reached God's Finger, and he paused there for a little lunch. The ground was high here, and looking back the way he had come, he could see moving lights. "On the turnpike," he thought. "They're looking for me." Tom looked northeast again. Far ahead, barely visible in the dark, the moon, now 2 nights past full, had already begun to sink. He saw a huge, rounded granite dome. He was supposed to go there next. "Tom's got sore feet," he whispered to himself, but not without some cheeriness. Things could have been much worse than a case of sore feet. M-O-O-N, that spells sore feet. He walked on, and the night things skittered away from him, and when he laid himself down at dawn, he had come almost 40 miles. The Nevada-Utah border was not far to the east of him. By 8 that morning, he was hard asleep, his head pillowed on his jacket. His eyes began to move rapidly back and forth behind his closed lids. Nick had come, and Tom had talked with him. A frown creased Tom's sleeping brow. He had told Nick how much he was looking forward to seeing him again. But for some reason he could not understand, Nick had turned away. Chapter 58. Oh, how history repeats itself. The trash can man was once again being broiled alive in the devil's frying pan. But this time there was no hope of Cibola's cooling fountains to sustain him. "It's what I deserve, no more than what I deserve." His skin had burned, peeled again, and finally it had not tanned but blackened. He was walking proof that a man finally takes on the look of what he is. Trash looked as if someone had doused him in No. 2 kerosene and struck a match to him. The blue of his eyes had faded in the constant desert glare, and looking into them was like looking into weird extra-dimensional holes in space. He was dressed in a strange imitation of the dark man, an open-throated red-checked shirt, faded jeans, and desert boots that were already scratched and mashed and folded and sprung. But he had thrown away his red flawed amulet. He didn't deserve to wear it. He had proved unworthy. He paused in the broiling sun and passed a thin and shaking hand across his brow. He had been meant for this place and time. All his life had been a preparation. He had passed through the burning corridors of hell to get here. He had endured the father-killing sheriff. He had endured that place at Terre Haute. He had endured Carly Yates. After all his strange and lonely life, he had found friends. Lloyd, Ken, Whitney Horgan. And, ah, God, he had fucked it all up. He deserved to burn out here in the devil's frying pan. Could there be redemption for him? The dark man might know. Trash can man did not. He could barely remember now what had happened, perhaps because his tortured mind did not want to remember. He had been in the desert for over a week before his last disastrous return to Indian Springs. A scorpion had stung him on the middle finger of his left hand, his fuck finger, that long-ago Carly Yates and that long-ago Poutonville would have called it with unfailing pool hall vulgarity. And that hand had swelled up like a rubber glove filled with water. An unearthly fire had filled his head. And yet he had pushed on. He had finally returned to Indian Springs, still feeling like a figment of someone else's imagination. There had been some good-natured talk as the men examined his finds, incendiary fuses, contact landmines, small stuff, really. Trash had begun to feel good for the first time since the scorpion had stung him. And then, with no warning at all, time had sideslipped, and he was back in Poutonville. Someone had said, "People who play with fire wet the bed, Trash," and he had looked up, expecting to see Billy Jameson, but it hadn't been Bill, it was Rich Groudmore from Poutonville, grinning and picking his teeth with a match, his fingers black with grease because he'd strolled up to the pool hall from the Texaco on the corner to have a game of nine ball on his break. And someone else said, "You better put that away, Richie, Trash is back in town." And that sounded like Steve Tobin at first, but it wasn't Steve. It was Carly Yates in his old scuffed and hoodie motorcycle jacket. With growing horror, he had seen they were all there, unquiet corpses come back to life. Richie Groudmore and Carly and Norm Morissette and Hatch Cunningham, the one who was getting bald even though he was only 18 and all of the others called him Hatch Cunnilingus. And they were leering at him. It came thick and fast then, through a fever haze of the years. "Hey, Trash, why didn't you torch the school? Hey, Trashy, you burned your pork off yet? Hey, Trash Can Man, I heard you snort Ronson lighter fluid, that true?" Then Carly Yates. "Hey, Trash, what did old Lady Semple say when you torched her pension check?" He tried to scream at them, but all that had come out was a whisper. "Don't ask me about old Lady Semple's pension check no more." And he ran. The rest of it was a dream, getting the incendiary fuses and slapping them on the trucks in the motor pool. His hands had done their own work, his mind far away. In Terre Haute, they had made him bite on a rubber thing when they gave him the shocks, and the man at the controls sometimes looked like the father-killing sheriff, and sometimes like Carly Yates, and sometimes like Hatch Cunnilingus. And he always swore hysterically to himself that this time he wouldn't piss himself. And he always did. When the trucks were fixed, he had gone into the nearest hangar and had fixed the choppers in there. He had wanted timer fuses to do that job right, and so he had gone into the mess hall kitchen and had found over a dozen of those five-and-dime plastic timers. You set them for 15 minutes or half an hour, and when they got back to zero, they went ding, and you knew it was time to take your pie out of the oven. Only instead of going ding this time, Trash had thought, they were going to go bang. He liked that. That was pretty good. If Carly Yates or Rich Groudmore tried to take one of those copters up, they were going to get a big fat surprise. He had simply hooked the timers up to the copter ignition systems. When it was done, a moment of sanity had come back, a moment of choice. He had stared around at the helicopters parked in the echoing hangar, and then down at his hands. They smelled like a roll of burned caps. This was not Poutonville. There were no helicopters in Poutonville. The Indiana sun did not shine with the savage brilliance of this sun. He was in Nevada. Carly and his pool hall buddies were dead, dead of the superflu. Trash had looked doubtfully at his handiwork. What was he doing, sabotaging the dark man's equipment? It was senseless, insane. He would undo it, and quickly. Oh, but the lovely explosions, the lovely fires, flaming jet fuel streaming everywhere, helicopters exploding out of the air. So beautiful. And he had suddenly thrown his new life away. He had trotted back to his sand crawler, a furtive grin on his sun-blackened face. He had gotten in and had driven away, but not too far away. He had waited, and finally a fuel truck had come out of the motor pool garage and had trundled across the tarmac like a large olive-drab beetle. And when it blew, exploding greasy fire in every direction, Trash had dropped his field glasses and had bellowed at the sky, shaking his fists in inarticulate joy. But the joy had not lasted long. It had been replaced by deadly terror and sick, mourning sorrow. He had driven northwest into the desert, pushing the sand crawler along at near suicidal speeds. How long ago? He didn't know. If he had been told that this was the 16th of September, he would only have nodded in a total blank lack of understanding. He thought he would kill himself, that there was nothing else left for him, but he hadn't done it. He didn't know why. But some force, more powerful than the agony of his remorse and loneliness, had stopped him. It seemed that even burning himself to death like a Buddhist monk was not penance enough. He had slept. And when he awoke, he discovered that a new thought had crept into his brain as he slept, and that thought was redemption. Was it possible? He didn't know. But if he found something, something big, and brought it to the dark man in Las Vegas, might it not be possible? And even if redemption was still impossible, perhaps atonement was not. If it was true, there was still a chance he could die content. What? Not landmines or a fleet of flame tracks, not grenades or automatic weapons. None of those things were big enough. He knew where there were two large experimental bombers. They had been built without congressional knowledge, paid for out of blind defense funds. But he could not get them back to Vegas. Even if he could, there was no one there who could fly them. From the looks of them, they crewed at least 10, maybe more. He was like an infrared scope that senses heat and darkness and reveals those heat sources as vague red devil shapes. He was able, in some strange way, to sense the things that had been left out in this wasteland where so many military projects had been carried out. He could have gone straight west, straight to Project Blue, where the whole thing had begun. But cold plague was not to his taste, and in his confused but not entirely illogical way, he thought it would not be to Flag's taste either. Plague didn't care who it killed. So he had gone northwest from Indian Springs into the sandy desolation of the Nellis Air Force Range, stopping his crawler when he had to cut through high barbed wire fences marked with signs that read, U.S. Government Property, No Trespassing, and Armed Sentries, and Guard Dogs, and There is a High Voltage Charge Passing Through These Wires. But the electricity was dead, like the guard dogs and the armed sentries, and Trash Can Man drove on, correcting his course from time to time. He was being drawn to something. He didn't know what it was, but he thought it was big. Big enough. The crawler's Goodyear balloon tires rolled steadily on, carrying Trash through dry washes and up slopes so rocky that they looked like half-exposed stegosaurus spines. The air hung still and dry. The temperature hovered at just above 100 degrees. The only sound was the drone of the crawler's modified Studebaker engine. He topped a knoll, saw what was below, and threw the transmission into neutral for a moment. There was a huddled complex of buildings down there, shimmering through the rising heat like quicksilver. Quonset huts in low cinder block. Vehicles stalled here and there on the dusty streets. The whole area was surrounded by three courses of barbed wire, and he could see the porcelain conductors along the wire. These were not the small conductors, the size of a knuckle, that passed along a weak stay-away charge. These were the giant ones, the size of a closed fist. A paved two-lane road led to a guardhouse. No cute little signs here saying, check your camera with NP on duty, or if you liked us, tell your congressman. The only sign in evidence was red on yellow, the colors of danger, curt and to the point. Present identification immediately. Thank you, Trash Can whispered. He had no idea who he was thanking. Oh, thank you, thank you. His special sense had led him to this place, but he had known it was here all along, somewhere. He put the crawler in its forward gear and lurched down the slope. 10 minutes later, he was nosing up the access road to the guardhouse. There were black and white striped crash barriers across the road, and Trash got out to examine them. Places like this had big generators to make sure there was plenty of emergency power. He doubted if any generator would have gone on supplying power for 3 months, but he would still have to be very careful and make sure everything was blown before going in. What he wanted was now very near at hand. He wouldn't allow himself to become overeager and get cooked like a roast in a microwave oven. Behind 6 inches of bulletproof glass, a mummy in an army uniform stared out and beyond him. Trash ducked under the crash barrier on the ingress side of the guardhouse and approached the door of the little concrete building. He tried it, and it opened. That was good. When a place like this had to switch over to emergency power, everything was supposed to lock automatically. If you were taking a crap, you got locked in the bathroom until the crisis was over. But if the emergency power failed, everything unlocked again. The dead sentry had a dry, sweet, interesting smell, like cinnamon and sugar mixed together for toast. He had not bloated or rotted. He had simply dried up. There were still black discolorations under his neck, the distinct trademark of Captain Trips. Standing in the corner behind him was a BAR. Trash can man took it and went back outside. He set the BAR for single fire, fiddled with the sight, and then socked it into the hollow of his scrawny right shoulder. He sighted down on one of the porcelain conductors and squeezed off a shot. There was a loud hand-clapping sound and an excited whiff of cordite. The conductor exploded every which way, but there was no purple-white glare of high-voltage electricity. Trash Can Man smiled. He went back to the sand crawler, put it in gear, and drove it through the crash barriers. They broke off with a snapping, grinding sound, and the crawler's big balloon tires rolled over them. The desert sun pounded down. Trash Can Man's peculiar eyes sparkled happily. He drove up the street to the first Quonset hut. It was a barracks. The shadowy interior was filled with that sugar and cinnamon smell. There were perhaps 20 soldiers scattered among the 50 or so beds. Trash Can Man walked up the aisle between them, wondering where he was going. There was nothing in here for him, was there? These men had once been weapons of a sort, but they had been neutralized by the flu. But there was something at the very rear of the building that interested him. A sign. He walked up to it and read. The heat in there was tremendous. It made his head thump and swell. But when he stood in front of the sign, he began to smile. Yes, it was here. Somewhere on this base was what he had been looking for. The sign showed a cartoon man in a cartoon shower. He was soaping his cartoon genitals busily. They were almost entirely covered with a drift of cartoon bubbles. The caption beneath read, "Remember, it is in your best interest to shower daily." Below that was a yellow and black emblem that showed three triangles pointed downward. The symbol for radiation. Trash Can Man laughed like a child and clapped his hands in the stillness. Chapter 59. Whitney Horgan found Lloyd in his room, lying on the big round bed he had most recently shared with Dana Jurgens. There was a large gin and tonic balanced on his bare chest. He was staring solemnly up at his reflection in the overhead mirror. "Come on in," he said when he saw Whitney. "Don't stand on ceremony, for Christ's sake. Don't bother to knock, bastard." It came out bastard. "You drunk, Lloyd?" Whitney asked cautiously. "Nope, not yet, but I'm getting there." "Is he here?" "Who, Fearless Leader?" Lloyd sat up. "He's around someplace. The Midnight Rambler." He laughed and lay back down. Whitney said in a low voice, "You want to watch what you're saying. You know it's not a good idea to hit the hard stuff when he's..." "Fuck it. Remember what happened to Heck Drogan. and Strellerton. Lloyd nodded. You're right. The walls have ears. The fucking walls have ears. You ever hear that saying? Yeah, once or twice. It's a true saying around here, Lloyd. You bet. Lloyd suddenly sat up and threw his drink across the room. The glass shattered. There's one for the sweeper, right, Whitney? You okay, Lloyd? I'm all right. You want a gin and tonic? Whitney hesitated for a moment. No, I don't like them without the lime. I got lime. Comes out of a little squeeze bottle. Lloyd went over to the bar and held up a plastic real lime. Looks just like the green giant's left testicle. Funny, huh? Does it taste like lime? Sure, Lloyd said morosely. What do you say? Be a man and have a drink with me. Yeah, okay. We'll have them by the window and take in the view. No, Whitney said, harshly and abruptly. Lloyd paused on his way to the bar, his face suddenly paling. He looked toward Whitney, and for a moment their eyes met. Yeah, okay, Lloyd said. Sorry, man, poor taste. That's okay. But it wasn't okay, and both of them knew it. The woman Flagg had introduced as his bride had taken a high dive the day before. Lloyd remembered Ace High saying that Dana couldn't jump from the balcony because the windows didn't open. But the penthouse had a sun deck. Guess they must have thought none of the real high rollers, Arabs most of them, would ever take the dive. A lot they knew. He fixed Whitney a gin and tonic, and they sat and drank in silence for a while. Outside, the sun was going down in a red glare. At last, Whitney said in a voice almost too low to be heard, "Do you really think she dived?" Lloyd shrugged. "What does it matter? Sure, I think she dived. You ready?" Whitney looked at his glass and saw with some surprise that he was indeed ready. He handed it to Lloyd, who took it over to the bar. Lloyd was pouring the gin freehand, and Whitney had a nice buzz on. Again they drank in silence for a while, watching the sun go down. "What do you hear about that guy Cullen?" Whitney asked finally. "Nothing. I don't hear nothing. Barry don't hear nothing. Nothing from Route 40, from Route 30, from Route 2 and 74 and I-15. Nothing from the back roads. They're all covered and they're all nothing. He's out in the desert someplace, and if he keeps moving at night and if he can figure out how to keep moving east, he's going to slip through. What does it matter anyhow? What can he tell them?" "I don't know." "No, I don't know either. Let him go, that's what I say." Whitney felt uncomfortable. Lloyd was getting perilously close to criticizing the boss again. His buzz on was stronger, and he was glad. Maybe soon he would find the nerve to say what he had come here to say. "I tell you something," Lloyd said, leaning forward. "He's losing his stuff. You ever hear that fucking saying? It's the eighth inning and he's losing his stuff and there's no fucking buddy warming up in the bullpen. Lloyd, you ready?" "Sure, I guess so." Lloyd made them new drinks. He handed one to Whitney, and a little shiver went through him as he sipped. It was almost raw gin. "Losing his stuff," Lloyd said, returning to his text. "First Dana, then this guy Cullen. His own wife, if that's what she was, goes and takes a dive. Do you think that was in his game plan?" "We shouldn't be talking about it." "And Trash Can Man. Look what that guy did all by himself. With friends like that, who needs enemies? That's what I'd like to know." Lloyd was shaking his head. "I don't understand it at all. Everything was going so good, right up to the night he came and said the old lady was dead over there in the free zone. He said the last obstacle was out of our way. But that's when things started to get funny. Now I just don't know. We can take him by land assault next spring, I guess. We sure as shit can't go before then. But by next spring, God knows what they might have rigged up over there, you know? We were going to hit them before they could think up any funny surprises, and now we can't. Plus, holy God on his throne, there's Trashy to think about. He's out there in the desert ramming around someplace, and I sure as hell... Lloyd, Whitney said in a low, choked voice, listen to me. Lloyd leaned forward, concerned. What? What's the trouble? I didn't even know if I'd have the guts to ask you, Whitney said. He was squeezing his glass compulsively. Me and Ace High and Ronnie Sykes and Jenny Engstrom, we're cutting loose. You want to come? Christ, I must be crazy telling you this with you so close to him. Cutting loose? Where are you going? South America, I guess. Brazil. That ought to be just about far enough. He paused, struggling, then plunged on. A lot of people have been leaving. Well, maybe not a lot, but quite a few, and there's more every day. They don't think Flag can cut it. Some are going north up to Canada. That's too friggin' cold for me. But I gotta get out. I'd go east if I thought they'd have me. And if I was sure we could get through. Whitney stopped abruptly and looked at Lloyd miserably. It was the face of a man who thinks he has gone much too far. You're all right, Lloyd said softly. I ain't gonna blow the whistle on you. It's all gone bad here, Whitney said miserably. When you plan to go? Lloyd asked him. Whitney looked at him with narrow suspicion. Oh, forget I asked, Lloyd said. You ready? Not yet, Whitney said, looking into his glass. I am. He went to the bar. With his back to Whitney, he said, I couldn't. I owe him something. I owe him a lot. He got me out of a bad jam back in Phoenix, but it's more than that. He's done something to me, made me brighter or something. I don't know what it is, but I ain't the same man I was, Whitney. Nothing like. Before him, I was nothing but a minor leaguer. Now he's got me running things here, and I do okay. It seems like I think better. Yeah, he's made me brighter. Lloyd lifted the flawed stone from his chest, looked at it briefly, then dropped it again. He wiped his hand against his pants as though it had touched something nasty. I know I ain't no genius now. I have to write everything I'm supposed to do in a notebook or I forget it. But with him behind me, I can give orders, and most time things turn out right. Before, all I could do was take orders and get in jams. I've changed, and he changed me. I've been with him since the start. It seems longer than it really is. Sometimes it seems like forever, you know. When we got to Vegas, there were 16 people here. Ronnie was one of them, so was Jenny and poor old Heck Drogan. They were waiting for him. When we got into town, Jenny Engstrom got down on those pretty knees of hers and kissed his boots. I bet she never told you that in bed. He smiled crookedly at Whitney. Now she wants to cut and run. Well, I don't blame her, or you either. But it sure doesn't take much to sour a good operation, does it? You're going to stick? I owe him that. He didn't add that he still had enough faith in the dark man to believe that Whitney and the others would end up riding cross trees, more likely than not. And there was something else. Here he was Flagg's second in command. What could he be in Brazil? Why, Whitney and Ronnie were both brighter than he was. He and Ace High would end up low chickens. And that wasn't to Lloyd's taste. Once he wouldn't have minded, but things had changed. And when your head changed, he was finding out, it most always changed forever. Well, it might work out for all of us, Whitney said lamely. Sure, Lloyd said, and thought. But I wouldn't want to be walking in your shoes if it comes out right for Flag after all. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes when he finally has time to notice you down there in Brazil. Riding a cross tree might be the least of your worries then. Lloyd raised his glass. A toast, Whitney. Whitney raised his own glass. Nobody gets hurt, Lloyd said. That's my toast. Nobody gets hurt. And I'll drink to that, Whitney said. And they both did. Whitney left soon after. Lloyd kept on drinking. He passed out around 9:30 and slept soddenly on the round bed. There were no dreams, and that was almost worth the price of the next day's hangover. When the sun rose on the morning of September 17th, Tom Cullen made his camp a little north of Gunlock, Utah. It was cold enough for him to be able to see his breath puffing out in front of him. His ears were numb and cold, but he felt good. He had passed quite close to a rutted, bad road the night before, and he had seen three men gathered around a small, spluttering campfire. All three had guns. Trying to ease past them through a tangled field of boulders, he was now on the western edge of the Utah Badlands, he had sent a small spatter of pebbles rolling and tumbling into a dry wash. Tom froze. Warm wee-wee spilled down his legs, but he wasn't even aware that he'd done it in his pants like a little baby until an hour or so later. All three of the men turned around, two of them bringing their weapons up to port arms. Tom's cover was thin, barely adequate. He was a shadow among shadows. The moon was behind a reef of clouds. If it chose this moment to come out... One of them relaxed. "It's a deer," he said. "They're all over the place." "I think we should investigate," another one had said. "Put your thumb up your asshole and investigate that," the third replied. And that was the end of it. They sat by the fire again, and Tom began to creep along, feeling for each step, watching as their campfire receded with agonizing slowness. An hour, and it was only a spark on the slope below him. Finally it was gone, and a great weight seemed to slip off his shoulders. He began to feel safe. He was still in the West, and he knew enough to still be careful. Laws, yes. But the danger no longer seemed as thick, as if there were Indians or outlaws all around. And now, with the sun coming up, he rolled into a tight ball in a low thicket of bushes and prepared to go to sleep. "Got to get me some blankets," he thought. "It's getting cold." Then sleep took him, suddenly and completely, as it always did. He dreamed of Nick.